Good evening. Hello, everybody. Thank you for taking time to be here tonight. And yeah, I'm overwhelmed by the number of people who are here. As Maxie said, it's really great to see all of you. And I'm looking forward to our engagements. And thank you also to the Vice Rector Meshke, for being here tonight. So kindness in the academy is a rare thing to find and experience. The nature of the work we do has increasingly forced us to compete, to engage with each other in ways that do not build, nurture ideas, and collaborate on producing knowledge. It is for this reason that I am honored to be in your company today. Over the years, I have known Professor Henriette Gunkel. We have tried in many ways, as she's mentioned, to nurture and care for each other's work, each other's lives, and contributions to society. This has been mainly in South Africa, where I live and work. So I am delighted to be here in Bochum, at MIAC in particular, and be part of a knowledge sharing and exchange practice so much aligned with my own politics and how Henriette and I have engaged with each other in the last 20 years. I'm grateful to MIAC and the Media Studies, Institute for Media Studies, and the whole team there, starting with you, Katya. Thank you very much. You have, Katya was very kind to pick me up at the airport very early in the morning. And we tried to find each other wearing masks. I can imagine what that looked like. To Natasha Frankenberg, for beautiful moments we have spent together and for the wonderful introduction to Bochum. And I've heard that you're probably the one person who really likes this city. Maximilian Brandt has been an absolute treasure, ensuring that I have everything I need. Thank you to you and to Charlotte for ensuring that I know my way around. It has been an immense pleasure to share space with some of the students in media studies, and I see some of them are here, and gender studies. Thank you to Astrid, Professor Astrid Dobermankowski, to Henriette, and to the students for beautiful moments of engagement, collective watching, and reflection, and mutual learning. In the short time I have spent here, I have felt a deep sense of community and kin. Thank you to Karim, to Renzo, Sophia, Zibil, and Ulrike Bergman for opening their homes and hearts to me. Without you, Henry, this would not be possible. Thank you for holding on for all these years and for the possibilities of what may come next. So the title of my talk is Intersectionality Revisited, an African Perspective. Intersectionality, I will add, has become a buzzword, much like decolonization, transformation, diversity, inclusion, and perhaps queer, although we may not agree on that one. In this revisit to intersectionality, the interest is to open up the concept and practice for new considerations and from a different perspective. In West African traditions, among the Akan, in particular in Ghana, this can be captured in the image of the Sankofa bird, which, while flying forward, has its head looking backwards and carrying an egg in its mouth. The symbolism, and this image, of course, is quite enriching theoretically. In her new book, Africana Queer Presence, Esa Nyek writes of Sankofa, and I quote, "A moment of deep contemplation where all directional aspirations collapse in the realization of the puzzling complexity that the image of Sankofa itself evokes. A present with necessary returns and life-bearing transformational paradigms for individual and communities. Close quote. As Professor Gunkel has mentioned in the introduction, a big part of my life at university has been spent on thinking about and crafting possibilities of resisting racism, anti-Blackness, sexual and gender normative regimes, and classism in the university space. In 2015, while at the University of Cape Town, which I'm sure you did go visit when you were there in October, the University of Cape Town, which is considered the top university in Africa, I was part of what I call one of the most revolutionary ideas of the decade. The idea was Rhodes Must Fall, an independent collective of students, workers, and staff who came together to end institutionalized racism and patriarchy at the University of Cape Town. To appreciate this idea, Rhodes Must Fall, one would need to consider, even if briefly, the context of South Africa in 2015. Cape Town, the city where the university is located, the beautiful city that I'm sure you've all heard about, and the politics around and in the university itself. In brief, South Africa is my opinion and reading. South Africa is suspended in time, a time that we can call after Mandela, a time of considering if the Rainbow Nation, as South Africa has been called, was real or a dream. And a time to ask, so what? What next? It appears that we have not moved on from this time. The idea of Rhodes Must Fall in 2015, at a time when the rhetoric at the university is transformation, illustrates the suspended time, where young people born after apartheid or post-1994 are enraged and cannot imagine a future that was a promise to them in Mandela time. It may be asked, why would the born freeze, Mandela's children, sprinkled with Madiba magic, that is, all those born at the cusp of a new South Africa, why would they be concerned with racism, anti-Blackness, colonialism, and resistant forms of apartheid at the top university in Africa? Let me briefly share this story. The first time I walked from the lower campus to the upper campus of the University of Cape Town, I felt a great sense of pride and achievement. I had managed, through my own efforts, to arrive at this prestigious university. This was not a simple arrival of just being present. I had arrived. I was marking my own position of having climbed the ladder to success. Walking around campus had no resemblance to any institution I had been part of in the country or around the country, even the ones comparable in stature. Perhaps it was the towering mountain that formed the backdrop of the upper campus, or maybe the ivy creeping its way up top to the top of each building, and most certainly the statue of Cecil John Rhodes that welcomed you and towered over the whole city. There was no friendly welcome at the university. No one acknowledged my existence, nor affirmed my position. Yet I felt like a relevant imposter. In 2011, 5 years after my first visit to the campus, I accepted the job at a new established research institute. It would be an understatement to say this was a dream come true. I had dreamt myself into existence. While negotiating a suitable salary package for my new job, my boss, a woman, very candidly told me I could not really imagine earning the same salary as my predecessor who had left for a job in England. He was, after all, more accomplished than I was, and a white man. Although we both had a PhD, and I a growing track record of academic publishing, his well-known status as a writer exceeded any academic achievements. He had never published an academic essay. I occupied his office, sat on his desk, and answered his phone. A year later, the phone rang, and I answered. "Johnny, it's your mother. Please get back to me urgently." He never left. I had been living in his shadow for a whole year. Framing intersectionality. We want to state that while this movement emerged as a response to racism at the University of Cape Town, we recognize that experiences of oppression on this campus are intersectional, and we aim to adopt an approach that is cognizant of this going forward. An intersectional approach to our Blackness takes into account that we are not only defined by our Blackness, but that some of us are also defined by our gender, our sexuality, our able-bodiedness, our mental health status, and our class, among other things. We all have certain oppressions and certain privileges, and this must inform our organizing so that we do not silence groups amongst us, and so that no one should have to choose between their struggles. Our movement endeavors to make this a reality in our struggle for decolonization. So this is part of the mission statement of the Roads Must Fall movement. And this was released on 25 March in 2015. In the mission statement, Roads Must Fall included a number of long-term goals, which attested to re-envisioning a university that would recognize the people it serves, their labor, as well as the teaching and learning practices in the institution. Among the long-term goals of RMF, or Roads Must Fall, was, and I quote from that list, implement a curriculum which critically centers Africa and the subaltern. By this we mean treating African discourses as the point of departure, through addressing not only content, but languages and methodologies of education and learning, and only examining Western traditions insofar as they are relevant to our own experience. So it is this invitation that I seek to address, not only in relation to the idea that was born in 2015, but on how far we have come to imagine anew the work that Roads Must Fall had started in and outside the university space. A classroom in crisis. The classroom, or the lecture theater, as we call it in South Africa, became an important site during the 2015 to 2017 protests, during Roads Must Fall and Fees Must Fall. So these movements overlapped. So 2015 was the beginning of Roads Must Fall, and then mid-2016, Fees Must Fall started, and these movements were quite related. A brief reflection on one teachable moment at the University of Cape Town during this time reveals the tensions that students battled with in a university that promises freedom and a reality that simultaneously defers that promise. The post-apartheid period of post-1994 South Africa often gives the impression that racial segregation and oppression are over. Linked to this is the idea that discussions about race, racism, oppression, and discrimination should flow easily or disappear from everyday conversations, because now we are post-race, right? Because we are rainbow. In reality, more than 20 years into democracy and the formal end of apartheid, South African people still struggle to critically engage with race and racism. This is more evident within a university space. At the height of the Roads Must Fall protests, we had to envision new ways of teaching and what issues to prioritize given the volatile debates around campus. So for a long time during Roads Must Fall, all classes were suspended and I was doing teach-ins in other parts of campus. So we occupied the management building. So the rector and the vice rector, they all had to leave. We slept in the building for 4 weeks and we offered a different curriculum to students. But there was a moment when we went back to the lecture halls or to the lecture theater. And this is a moment I reflect on. So this is in one classroom and the course is called Intersectionality. It's offered in the sociology department. 300 students are in the class, undergraduate students. And I choose to show a video by artist Bonolo Kavula. Viewing this collectively ignited a new wave of student engagement in relation to race, anti-Blackness, class divisions, domesticity, and gender relations. For many students, it appeared that they'd never been granted an opportunity to openly discuss race, racism, and apartheid throughout their academic careers. Doing so in a classroom setting at university during protests on high tuition fees and remnants of colonization offered new vigor. A year before Roads Must Fall, visual artist and former student of UCT Fine Arts, Bonolo Kavula, shot the video, which is a 2.5-minute video. It's entitled, You Must Be Exhausted. And it's shot in black and white. The video displays a body with its head off the frame in a process of making tea. The clothed torso, assumed to be that of a woman, repeats the tea-making process, adding sugar in the white cup, a tea bag, water, milk, stirring, removing the teaspoon and serving. The opening phrase, have the Boers gone away? Starts this sequence of repetitions. In You Must Be Exhausted, Kavula refers to a scene in the film Sarafina, a 1994 film on the Soweto student uprising in the 1970s. The scene referred to in the video is of Sarafina, the main character, visiting her mother, who is a domestic worker, at her white employer's home in the suburbs. The voice heard repeats the dialogue in the film. The madam in conversation with a Mrs. van der Merwe, who has come for a visit. After being offered a number of drinks to be prepared by the maid, Mrs. van der Merwe is invited to sit down. And this is from the film. You walked all the way from the front gate on your own legs. Ha! Huh, you must be exhausted. Next time, you wait by the gate and the maid will carry you. These Black women are so strong. Close quote. In the video, Kavula uses repetition of sound and visuals to comment on the coexistence and continuity of apartheid and post-apartheid within the domestic sphere. So I'll invite the media studies students to watch this and perhaps draw their own analysis on repetition as technique. Mm-hmm. Three particular moments in the video unsettle the classroom. Each addresses a specific motif dealing with dismemberment, facelessness, and strong Black women. Paying close attention to these motifs bears relevance to this essay and to the call the RMF made a year after this video. The maid will carry you. These Black women are so strong. This repetition reinforces Black women's subjugation in the home work environment. While the video references a relationship between a Black domestic worker and white madams, students watching this video were relating to it to their and to their own circumstances within the university space. Black students and students of color in particular expressed how they had to work harder than white students to get into university and maintain the standards of whiteness demanded by the university. While university entry seemed to be based on merit, for Black students and students of color, it was also racialized. Merit alone makes assumptions of indifference, that all students perform under equal circumstances and thus gain access equally. Yet merit, codified as non-racial and making it into the white world, erased Black students' racialized intellectual and emotional labor. For students, this video art also showed how the value of Black people's extra labor is undermined and yet continues to be extracted. Within the classroom setting, Black students went to task highlighting how they were adding to white students' understanding of the social reality and how they provide pedagogical value for white students and white staff. Often, there was no equivalent return, as Black students expressed. The relationship between Black students performing affective labor and white students and staff as receptors within the classroom setting was seen as exploitative. Some were benefiting off the backs and lived experiences of others. Thus, Black students at university felt like maids who had to continue the labor of the white institution, while simultaneously being reminded that they have to be thankful for accessing university. It is also in this realm that another trigger in Kavula's video was experienced. The gendered nature of domestic labor angered many students. Some expressed for the first time memories of growing up with mothers who are domestic workers. The added burden of Black mothers who deny their children or families sufficient care because they care for white families was underscored in the video as, "My maid will carry you." Student asked, "If my mother carries other white women, their husbands and children, who cares for me?" While caring was unlike the care that Black children demanded from their mothers, the former exhausted the latter. This form of labor, of caring others, was understood as Black women's bodies being reduced to limbs and muscle. Jennifer Nash similarly notes how Black women are subjects who witness what is meant to be kept invisible and named unseen. While this video was angering for some, what many students were able to grasp were the intersections between race, class, gender, as they shift and continue from the domestic space to the university space. The university, as a contested space, demanded revisioning. How do we ensure that the university or the classroom space does not perpetuate the demand for affective and extractive labor from Black students, Black women, and other minoritized groups? The notion of resilience, bouncing back from all forms of hardship, crisis, oppression, and injustice, has become a key feature in Black women's survival in the academy. I add it here because it is an assumption. There's an assumption that Black students will bounce back even when they continue to be made invisible, disposable, and places of extraction. Through this video and many aesthetic practices during Rhodes Must Fall and Fees Must Fall, it was possible for students to refuse resilience and its silencing. And what they did was to expose the pains of bouncing back and critique structural inequality. I won't talk about that, but there are many forms that were used during that time. Most specifically, the conversations through the video made permissible by this video art demand that we recraft a new point of departure when engaging scholarship. For the South African context, that means offering a new way of being Black in the world, as demanded by the students and the calls made by RMF. Chabani Manganyi asserts an understanding of African ontology, which is analysis and understanding of existence, is a requirement for the possible formulation of what it means to be Black in the world. It is about being human in South Africa and the conditions that makes this possible. What then do we make of intersectionality and what it means to be human within the South African context? As noted in the RMF mission statement, which I read earlier, South African universities are faced with the challenge of treating African discourses as the point of departure through addressing not only content, but languages and methodologies of education and learning. What would this mean for the classroom space and beyond the university? The example mentioned earlier is a popular course at the University of Cape Town. And that course, everyone wants to sign up for that one. It's called Race, Class, Gender, Sexuality. And over the last few years, the course has had a number of iterations, sometimes engaging with balancing each of the concepts while unsure what frame to use to engage with these intersecting categories. This lack of framing and reliance on intersectionality as a theoretical frame and analysis has raised a number of challenges for teaching in the vernacular and outside the university classroom. I mention this because I do a lot of work outside university spaces or with university spaces. Without eschewing the important work of intersectionality, we also have to engage with the universal validity of concepts traveling from the global north and what this project does in terms of entrenching the West as the point of departure. A year since the formation of Roads Must Fall, a few Black writers, literary and feminist scholars met in the city of Durban in South Africa for the festival, which is called Time of the Writer. Many of us had been part of Roads Must Fall in different ways, either as supporters, commentators from other parts of the country, or part of the physical formation of the movement. In March 2016, as we were celebrating and reflecting on the work done by Roads Must Fall, which had now been a year old, we gathered at a community library in a township outside Durban. The workshop planned was intersectionality. It was during the day at about 2:30 p.m. when the workshop started. In the audience were school children, many still wearing their uniforms, and the elderly who were taking care of grandchildren and thus not in formal employment. As the workshop started in English, a voice from the crowd shouted, "Could you please speak isiZulu, asikuzwa?" The speaker, an elderly woman, stated that she was very eager to understand what was being said, but could not follow. The task at hand seemed onerous. The facilitator had to quickly revise a plan as she could not explain the theme of the event in the local language, isiZulu. Another voice asked, "Mntanam, yini le intersectionality nikhuluma ngayo?" The key question, what exactly is this intersectionality you are talking about? As we looked across the table of learned writers and scholars, it dawned on us that we did not know what we were talking about without the use of or reliance on English. We were, as Richard Littlebear notes, confronted with a voracious language, English, that gobbles up everything in its way. It's a pity I'm also having to use it. Not only could we not translate ourselves and our thinking, but we did not have the tools and the language to speak of intersectionality in our own language. In this world, in this community in Durban, intersectionality had no meaning. We were then faced with the task of collectively working on undoing what we understood and listening for new ways in which intersectionality could emerge locally and contextually. African languages as a source of knowledge could help us understand other ways of being, other ways of being situated, fit for local conditions. Linguistic translations to single words can distort history and reality, thus demanding a resistance to misinterpretations, So in this particular context, I'm not going to translate this term. So the translation of ukuhlangana kobuntu back to intersectionality in English would be a devaluation of indigenous languages and a process of meaning making. Ukuhlangana kobuntu emerges as a collective understanding of how our societies should move forward. It references the need for collective building, ukuhlangana, understanding that the fractures in our society have been formed by the differences amongst us as a people. That without a common purpose, even our struggles can never intersect. In referencing ukuhlangana at this community library, we were signaling Black people's histories and legacies, despite their differences, through collectives such as Umhlangano and Manyano, a collective of religious women who are very visible in Black communities all over South Africa. And both these, Umhlangano and Umanyano, are synonymous to Black township and village everyday life in South Africa. Ukuhlangana kobuntu is a way of life, a theoretical positioning, a framework or standpoint. It is a point of departure for this community that envisions itself as going forward collectively. Derived from the African philosophy, African ethic, worldview, and practice grounded in humanness, connectivity, and dignity, which is ubuntu, it brings to focus the importance of returning humanness to people. Umuntu, mutu, muto, bantu. Ubuntu, which is part of ukuhlangana kobuntu, is the spirit of interconnectedness, the capacity to affirm our humanity through recognizing and celebrating others who are different from us, while maintaining a flexible sense of self that allows us to mirror each other for the purpose of co-creating shared values. Ubuntu highlights that one's aim in life should be to exhibit humanness, which is done by valuing collective relationships with others. The human, which is umuntu in African society, exists as a relational being, connected to others, and thus becomes umuntu through this connection. There is no individuality. Ukuhlangana kobuntu gestures to how African people or Black people continue to be dehumanized by the structures and systems in place in the world. So to call for ukuhlangana kobuntu is to call for the collective energies that will heal the wounds causing Black dismemberment, pain, and subjection. Jabulani Ndebele poignantly asks, what is it that constituted relief from Black pain? The Black body in pain needed to be affirmed as human against its dehumanizing depreciation. Thus, the Black body would need to return to the essence of its humanness, which has been stripped off through colonization, apartheid, racism, and anti-Blackness. We make our approaches to the world through our bodies. This body is movement. The body is movement inwards and outwards. Chabane Manganya gives us this offering. The body is movement inwards and outwards. Sara Ahmed would refer to this as being oriented towards others, towards things, and towards nature. Similarly, Jennifer Nash would concur when stating, who people are can never be understood from the way things work, suggesting this relationality in being a person, a human together. So this is an invitation to all of us to think and position ukuhlangana kobuntu as our point of departure. I thank you.